Help Jews in Poverty this Passover at helpjewsnow.org. Holocaust survivors are forced to choose between food and medicine. Coronavirus has robbed families of their livelihoods. Your $25 gift today will help provide a life-saving food box to Jews in need. Don't wait. Passover is quickly approaching. You can be a blessing this holy season. You can help Jews now who have no one else. Visit helpjewsnow.org. That's helpjewsnow.org.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the 5 Rounds Podcast, the only podcast out there with the cardio for those deep water championship rounds. I'm Mags, and with me today, as always, my son Carlos. Carlos, how are you?
Not too bad, how are you?
Yeah, I'm surprised you're still awake at this time. You haven't took the obligatory 3 a.m. nap. But yeah, we've just got through watching UFC on ESPN 19, Hermanson versus Vittori. A card that was ravaged very late in the day, with three fights being called off due to COVID and other illnesses. So we only ended up with three fights on the prelims. Started with Gian Vellante getting beat by Jake Collier in the heavyweight by decision. Then Ilia Topuria getting the first round knockout of Damon Jackson in the featherweight. And then the feature prelim, Luis Smolka getting the second round knockout of Jose Alberto Quinones in the bantamweight. Going into the main card, and we start with a contender series winner, contract winner, Jordan Levitt, making his official UFC debut against a veteran, Matt Wyman. And the guy wanted to make a statement, and make a statement he did. There was one punch thrown in this whole fight, and that was by Wyman, and it missed. Levitt was able to keep hold of Wyman when Wyman like jumped upon him to grab his neck and try to pull guard, and just maneuver his arms into a position to keep Wyman's head in the ideal spot. So when Levitt was able to drop Wyman with a slam, Wyman's head just bounced off the floor, and Wyman went nana. 22 seconds in, Jordan Levitt has knocked out Matt Wyman and picked up an amazing first victory in the UFC.
Yeah, what more can you say on that? This is literally how it happened. He didn't take a punch, and he slammed the guy on his head. Going in from what Dominic Cruz was saying about how it's illegal shots to the back of the head, and I don't know what he were looking at.
No, it was comparing if Wyman would have been hit with a punch there, it would have been disqualification. But with the slam, it's perfectly legal.
That's yeah, but then the slam's at the side of the head. Like we both saw it, he got slammed on the side of the head, so it wasn't exactly behind the ear or the back of the head. So it was on the side. The way I looked at it, it was on the side. But yeah, what more can you say about from he slammed his opponent and he's gone 8-0.
I mean, usually when we're watching the fights, one of us will maybe miss the first few minutes, and that was a case of me screaming and Carlos literally running into the room and like, what have I missed? What have I missed? And he missed a 22-second knockout. Luckily, we were able to like see the replay in full so many times before the next fight.
It just reminded me a lot of Rampage slams.
But just it was the arm positioning for me though. That a lot of the time you'll see a slam and it's a case of just going for broke and not really having technique behind it. That was done purposely. He did that with effect and knowing to put his arms there, knowing that he's keeping Wyman's head and making sure it hits that canvas rather than Wildman being able to like kind of cushion the blow was perfectly done by Jordan Levitt, and congratulations to him.
Yeah, definitely congratulations to him. The fact he were able to be quick thinking in that situation, whereas when Matt's trying to pull guard, like you were saying, he's able to put his arms in the right direction for him to slam that on the ground. So yeah, that's a big congratulations and a big statement for your UFC debut.
Yep. So let's go on then into the next fight in the light heavyweight division. We had John Allen taking on Roman Dolidze, and this was a very dominant fight for Dolidze. He was so good on the feet with his shots. He was very, very quick with his punches. But then when he went to ground, he was so aggressive with attempting the heel hook and the leg lock, the figure four, but the Boston Crab. This guy thought he was playing a wrestling game. Allen just didn't seem to have a lot to answer for him. Even when Allen was able to land shots, Dolidze was smiling and laughing him off. And when he had Allen on the floor, and Allen was dropping those heels into the quads of Dolidze, it just didn't seem to be affecting him at all. I was surprised that Dolidze wasn't able to actually get the finish, and Allen was able to take it to the judges. What was even more surprising was one of the judges gave it 3 rounds to Allen, which they made a massive issue about it on the commentary of how this has been able to happen. Chris Lee, I think it was the judge, yeah, that gave the fight to Allen, and I tend to agree with Dominic Cruz saying that these judges do need to like kind of justify how they did that, because objectively, with having no like kind of real dog in this fight, I give Roman Dolidze all three rounds. I felt that he was so dominant. He was able to take the fight down when he wanted. Anytime he was taken down himself, he was able to scramble and reverse position and get back into top control and into guard. It's just a very, very dominant fight for Roman Dolidze, and John Allen seems to have a lot of work to do. That's his UFC debut and his first UFC loss, and Roman Dolidze picks up his second win and still is unbeaten in his career, so good on him. But we do need to kind of like look at this judging situation and see why these people are allowed to judge, because they don't seem to be watching the fight.
Yeah, most definitely the judges need looking at, but it was clear Roman won the fight. I give John the first round, and then I give Roman the second and third. Just off the first round, John being able to give his own shots off in the first, and then being able to defend on the ground, and obviously as the fight went on into the second and third, you trying to defend submission after submission when someone's trying to submit you, it tires you, it takes gas out of you. So obviously Johnny just he slowed down a little bit, but and Roman were able to pick up the bits of the pieces where he couldn't do in the first round. In the second round, when he was getting onto the ground, he was actually doing a lot more ground and pound, which is the punches, and obviously whereas Dominic Cruz and Paul Felder were saying the judges need to start looking at it as, just because you're punching them on the feet doesn't mean that it's not effective when you're punching them on the ground. I do agree with them. Like, a lot of the boxing judges who have transitioned over to mixed martial arts don't have a clue about the grappling side of it, and I think the only time it makes it easier for them is if someone's like Khabib, and if they're taking their opponent down and just beating the face in from start to finish. And mm-hmm. That's not always the case. You've got fighters. This is mixed martial arts. The word mixed in there is in there for a reason. So it's, yeah, I do agree with him. It's a bullshit call for what he did. Now we all know, if you knew how to even slightly look at a fight to judge it, you knew that John lost that fight. You knew that he didn't win. Yeah. John knew that he lost that fight. You seen it on his face when it called it out. We're at 28-27.
Yeah.
It was like, he looked at it like, what the fuck? How's that possible? And I think even me and you looked at each other like, what the fucking fight were you watching? And it's, obviously Paul Felder was shocked when John Anik said, told him like, surprise, surprise, it was the same judge you give it you when
yeah.
when you clearly didn't win. And
he was fully admitted it. He was saying, I don't believe how I won that fight.
Yeah, even, so it's, what's his name, the judge, so we can...
Chris Lee.
Chris Lee, that's his name, the shit judge. And he is, just because he shouldn't be able to, like I said to Keir, they get paid a decent whack for judging these fights. And there is so many different people out there, especially ex-fighters, where the biggest argument comes into place of ex-fighters should be judges. Fair enough, I totally agree with that, they should. Especially when you have calls like this. And it's just stupid. It's like exactly how Paul and Dom said. They'll watch the fight when it's stood up, but when it comes to grappling, they'll just start looking away, they'll just start doing something else. And it's like, your job's to watch the fight.
Yeah.
Not just watch it when you want to and start and score it when you want to. Watch the full fight, and if you don't know what you're doing, don't take that job to be a judge.
And that's why I always kind of support the call for ex-fighters to be judges, because they know what they're looking for. They know how to score an MMA fight, whereas a lot of these judges are still like living in the ages of a boxing call, and they don't understand the kind of like intricacies of MMA. And for a layman, it may look like one person is not doing much, but the work he's putting in, the control and the way he's dominating his opponent, it just seems to be overlooked by a lot of these judges when they don't know what they're meant to be looking for.
Yeah, definitely. So obviously, when you're a judge and you're looking at stuff like that, you've got to take it into account. Look at Tony Ferguson when he's on his bike; he fights a hell of a lot off his bike, throwing upward elbows and throwing amethysts and jabbing you in the teeth when he's on his back. But the judge looks at it then and goes, right, who's winning? The guy who you could look at going, he's in top control and got fully control in that situation, or the guy who's actually punching the guy's face in from the bottom, who's in control? That's where these judges sort of like, oh, I ain't got a clue here, because I'm usually judging boxing here or a different sport. So it's like, that's where the other fighters, if you were to use ex-fighters as judges, they'll be able to see that. They'll be able to know, hang on a minute, he might be on top position and top control, but he's just lying there, he's doing absolutely nothing. Yeah. The guy on the bottom is actually winning this round because he's actually trying more. He's working to get to his feet, or he's working for a sub, or he's working to transition. And it's just all like you said, going into the intricacies of grappling. And that's, if you don't know what you're looking at, to some people it can be like, what the fuck's winning here, what's going on, I best not score this then, I'll wait till they stand up. And it just pisses you off, especially when you've got, because that could have, the other judge could have easily done the exact same, and that could have gone out of Roman's hands, which wouldn't have been fair.
No
So it does need looking at, and something does need changing.
Definitely. So let's get into the middle fight of this card. Another first round knockout. Gabriel Benitez versus Justin James. It was a fairly even fight at the beginning, with Justin James and Benitez landing big shots, landing leg kicks. But as the fight went on, you could see that Benitez had more power than James, and James seemed to be more wild with his throws. Like, there was no real aim at accuracy. It was just like swing for the fences kind of stuff. But Benitez was able to pick him off with those leg kicks and kind of really stunt his pressing. There was a point where James arpoked Benitez, and you could see a really black welt coming up underneath Benitez's left eye. But after that, he didn't really give James much option to capitalise on it, because he landed a low kick. James went in to kind of like bum rush and a knee to the body, went down, collapsed. You could just see it was just... It just killed the fight. It absolutely killed the fight. From the angle that we saw, it looked like it cleaned him out by a knee to the head, but the replay and the angle changes showed that it was clear in the lungs. James was just out for the count because of that. Benitez landed a couple of shots which didn't really need to happen and picked up the first round knockout.
Yeah, what? Like you said, this fight was definitely evenly matched coming into it. They were both swinging and mm-hmm. both looking for the finish, whichever way they could possibly get it. And which, obviously, this was only the first round, and which surprised me. Gabriel actually threw over 100 shots. This is the first round, so just imagine if this went on and you could have broke a record. But in the first round, and he didn't land that many shots. He only landed like 30 odd of the 100 he actually threw, but he was able to get the job done. And to time the knee, it was... Now, whether he practiced that or wasn't anticipating for that, I'll never know. But the fact that he were able to just place the knee perfectly as Justin were coming in, it was just in the proper sweet spot, and once you get it in there, that's it, you're done. Yeah. Like Justin did, his body basically just went stiff and he fell down. It was like getting knocked out.
Yeah.
And if that's exactly, it just takes your wind, you can't breathe. It feels like someone's like just kicked your chest and stood there. So it's like, how do you breathe? I forgot, is it two in, one out? Is it three out, one in? As soon as he did that, I just felt for Justin's ribs more than all. Cause I'm like, I've been in that pain one or two times before, and it's not a good feeling. But it weren't the worst one on the card. Let's just put it that way. The slam was worse than obviously on the prelims. A guy literally died on the prelims.
To be fair, I wouldn't want any of them.
No, not a chance. But yeah, coming into this fight, Gabriel had a... Could have been a game plan, or it could have just been, fuck it, let's go in for the kill. But either way, I was going to say it was a game plan, because he did seem to me like he wanted to set that knee up. But like, to me, he were lifting that leg up a couple of times and he didn't do much with it. So to me, that tells me he were either trying to set something coming apart or trying to set that knee up, and he didn't really throw many head kicks, and he was trying to set the knee up. So yeah, I'm gonna give it to him. I'm gonna say that was his game plan, and he was trying to finish with the knees. So well done to fucking Gabriel, yeah, making moves on that lightweight.
Great victory for him. Going into the light heavyweight division, with our co-main event, Jamal Hill and Ovin St. Preux. Now, going into this fight, Ovin's was the first time in his 40 fight career that he's ever missed weight. And looking at the fight afterwards, I feel that he just wasn't motivated for this fight at all. Mm. We all know that Ovin St. Preux is not the most explosive fighter. He doesn't come across as someone who expends a lot of energy. He's very kind of meticulous and very measured with his shots, but this was a fighter that didn't look like he wanted to be in the octagon. We started the first round. It was a little bit nervous from both, trying to kind of gauge the range, kind of work out what shots they were able to use. I think that Hill had a really good first round, was able to pick off way more shots than St. Pierre. And I loved his no-look body shots, the way he was really digging in at St. Pierre, and Ovin's just didn't seem to have a lot to answer, but he also didn't look like he was particularly worried about it. When he did throw stuff, I mean, take for example his leg kicks, he threw one pretty weak leg kick for in terms of an OSP shot, and it nearly sweeped Hill totally off his feet. In the later minutes of the round, he was able to pull a clinch and was able to do a little bit of a control up against the cage. But any time that Hill was free and able to, he was landing way more shots, and he quickly was able to build up like a points lead in that round. Going into the second, we saw a lot more of the same. St. Preux taking his very calm, measured, almost like he didn't care approach to it. Hill lands one shot that was so hard that he knocked his own mouthpiece out. And then he just kind of like, whether he sensed that OSP wasn't able to hurt him or something like that, but he was able to just start turning up the output, and was able to land shots with knowing that he wasn't going to take any shots back or any damage. And then he landed a few big punches, and you could see how it cleaned Ovince's clock, and you could see he had to kind of like shake out the cobwebs. But Hill kept that pressure up and was just able to land so many big shots. He didn't technically knock St. Preux out, but he landed so many accurate shots in such a quick succession that Ovince just had no answer at all, and he was kind of like saved by Jason Herzog when Jason came in and saw that St. Preux was not all there, and Jamal Hill picks up a really big victory, and St. Preux, are we saying he needs to finish? Are we saying that might be the calling card for Ovince, because he just didn't look like he wanted to be there?
I'd say give him one more fight. Like then his record, I think his last 3-5, 3 wins, 5 losses in it since like last couple of years.
You've also got to remember though, this is a guy who I mean, we were speaking about it in the fight. He took Bones to decision, and since then he's really struggled to find his place. I mean, he's had dalliances in heavyweight. Got absolutely destroyed there, come back to lightweight, and he's struggling to get back to championship form. It's a hard one because I like Ovince St. Preux. I just don't think he's got the passion for it anymore.
Yeah, he's a good guy. He's one of these Corby Covingtons that people can't stand. But like I said to you, I think he came in at the wrong time. He came in when the Bones era was still about, and that's happened to many fighters in the light heavyweight division. Bones was at the top. Everyone's always fighting for that place. Number one's always beating number two. Number two's always beating number three, but no one's beating the champion. And it's basically just a back and forth. And it was up until DC started getting in the picture and mixing stuff up, and that obviously, like you were saying, when he took Jones to decision, you would have thought that would have been a massive confidence booster, and people who said that he couldn't be beat, I've just took him to decision. So I ain't got a clue what went wrong after that, bar from he did lose his confidence, and I just don't think he's been able to regain that. And in this fight, it was weirdly like he didn't have any confidence in the first place, and as the fight went on, he just lost more and more confidence. And Jamal, he somewhat looked the same. He looked like you can tell when someone's putting a face on. He was shitting himself. You could tell he was nervous, and I don't blame him. At the end of the day, Ovince St. Preux, he's got power in his hands. If he hits you, he's going to hurt you. And Jamal knew that, so I think he was just more of game face, shit is it, man, hang on a minute, that weren't too bad. And that's when his confidence started building up, because he started hitting him more, started like getting a bit more loose with his shots, getting a bit more throw in a bit more shots. He was able to just get more loose in the game, get more confident, rather than just staying that tight. He was able to get more of his own offense off and push St. Preux into the fence and push him about the octagon, showing St. Preux that, oh, I'm not scared of you. You've hit me, and it's not fazed me. So I'm just gonna go to work on you. And it's as simple as that. And Jamal knew that he weren't gonna knock him out with one shot. He doesn't seem that type of guy. He's got the power for that. He's got the sort of bone sort of power where it's not one punch. It's over a bit of time where he's kicking fuck out your body and then. Kicking a couple to the chin, then destroying your legs, and then back to the body, and he's got to chop you down piece by piece to get you, but eventually he will get you there if you don't stop him. And this is the guy who said that he went from playing basketball, or wanted to play college basketball, to having a kid work at a factory, to then watching Anderson Silva on a TV, to then going, I want to do that. Now he's fighting in the UFC, and he's now in the top 15.
Yeah.
He's took over in St. Preux's ranking, 7-0. He's couple of fights into the UFC. His UFC contract.
9-0 now. 9-0, 3-0
in the UFC. 3-0 in the UFC. That's a good record, especially against some of the people he's got already beat in the UFC.
But the hard work starts here now.
Definitely, the hard work definitely does start here, especially when you get the top 15 to top 7. Obviously, that's where you're going to be doing a lot of the work, obviously climbing up, and then above that, that's where he's got to really turn his A game on. Cause when you're in the UFC, in the biggest organisation, once you're in that pool of killers, you've got to be one of them killers, because if not, they will kill you.
Yeah.
It's as simple as that. And Jamal's still got a lot of work to do. Like, his head's still in the same place. His head movement's not all there. He'll put his head to the side a little bit, but then bring it back, and then he'll put it to the side a little bit, and then he'll bring it back. And I was surprised that Owen St. Preux or his corner didn't see that as he were doing it. Now, obviously, in the heat of the moment, the coaches, the fighters there, you're not going to see everything. It sounds easy for me to say it now, and can understand that. I've just been watching it on telly, so it's a little bit different. You can see the different angles. Sometimes you can't pick stuff up when you're there in the moment, so you can't really blame him too much. But yeah, maybe that's a thing Jamal works on going on in the future. But to say he's 9-0 moving on, that's incredible. Especially, and how old is he? He's only 30, he's 30 odd. Yeah.
Late 20s, I think.
So he's got plenty of time to still evolve. What I wouldn't like him to see is, just because he's beat Owen St. Preux now and he's one of these Dana White's contender series guys, and I wouldn't like him to try and jump too far ahead and think, I'm up here, when really I'm still down here, just because of all the hype and stuff like that. I'm getting sort of sick of fighters doing that sort of stuff. It's like, especially the young fighters, older fighters, fair enough, you know, you won't get a lot of time left, put all your eggs in one basket and go for it. But when they're the young fighter and you do that, you're going to end up the next Paige Van Zandt, the next Sage Northcutt, the next young people who goes, oh yeah, I'm the next dog bollocks because I've been told this of this such and this person, and now, you know, I'm not even in the UFC anymore, I'm fighting in Asia.
Yeah.
So I'd like him to see him just chill out, and I wouldn't say pick his fights, because obviously a lot of people don't really like that saying, but choose his fights wisely.
Yeah, that absolutely makes sense. Well, let's get into this main event, and wow, what a doozy it was. Jack Hermanson coming in at ranked 4, 6, 11, no matter what number UFC plucks out of their arse. Marvin Vettori from the prelims up to the fights he started, I think he gained about three spots in the rankings. But this was a great fight to watch. Marvin Vettori, a late replacement for Kevin Holland, who was a late replacement for, I don't even know who the original fight were, but this was essentially Jack Hermanson's third opponent for this event. But he actually came into the fight as favourite, did Vettori, which was very, very interesting. And do you know what? He absolutely proved it, because he ground out a very comprehensive victory. The first two rounds went very, very similar. Vettori was heavy hitting with that left hand, even though Karloff noticed before the fight that he in the corner to get getting prepared to get into the octagon, he was favouring his left arm, really, that kind of rubbing it. So it was interesting to see how many shots he actually threw with that left hand, and was still kind of like, you could catch him every so often in the fight, like really favouring it and kind of rubbing it. You could tell that it was giving him some grief. Needless to say, he hit Hermanson with that left hand so many times, it's unreal. And then there was a point in the first round where he drops Hermanson. He was Vettori was able to control pretty much the rest of the round on the floor. Attempted a guillotine a few times, but kind of give it up because he didn't want to lose position. Was able to land shots to the ribs, especially when Dominic Cruz was saying, yeah, he's not eating any shots here, just after he'd been punched in the ribs about 35 times. Going into the second round, a lot of the same. Hermanson came out with a massive right, and you could see that he was looking to be more wild with his shots, but Vettori was just able to pick him off with that left. That was the key factor for me, was the amount of significant strikes that Vettori was able to pick off, the efficiency. I think at the end of the fight it said he landed 41% of his shots, and this is a fight where between the guys they threw 800 shots and landed over 300 significant strikes. So this was a brutal, like, proper battle of a fight.
Well, they've literally, these two, obviously Jack and Mervin, they've literally, just before I came in, John Anik was saying, these two in this fight have broke the record.
I'm not surprised.
9 significant strikes more than what Robert Whittaker and Yoel Romero, Gastelum, or whoever it were who had the record. Mm-hmm. These have got the record now.
I think it was Gastelum and Adesanya. It might have been Gastelum and Whittaker, actually. It was just a brutal fight. And after the second round, which went pretty much the same way as the first round, where Vettori was able to take Hermanson to the ground and control the fight, we saw a different Hermanson come out in that third round. And whether that was Vettori tiring, we know now what the problem was, but watching at the time, we could have thought, oh, this was Vettori kind of gassing out, and Hermanson was going to use his kind of knowledge of five round fights to take this victory. But what we actually learned was that it was Vettori taking a breather, knowing that he was going to go into those five rounds and wanting to conserve energy for the deep water rounds. And it was such a well-worked game plan, because even though it was almost like a chess move. He knew he had to sacrifice there, but he was able to not take a lot of damage, lost the round, but then was able to regain that composure and that energy for round 4 and 5, where he just turned the dial up, was able to slip Hermanson's shots, was able to land that left again, was landing kicks, and you could see how he was tearing Hermanson's face up. And fair play to Hermanson, this guy is a warrior, he's an absolute warrior. You don't get into the position that he's got into in the UFC without having skill and heart and power. But this was a Vettori who wanted to make a statement and move up in the division. I believe that he has done. And he ended up, for me, taking the fight very handily on the cards, winning 4-1. Going to the last round, though, he very, very nearly gave it up with about a minute or so left. We saw a bit of a groundwork on the floor, and then Hermanto was able to slide a heel hook with about 10 seconds to go on, and if he could have been able to lock that in, that would have been one of the comebacks of the UFC calendar for me. But Vettori was able to get out of it, ended the fight on top, wins by decision, all three judges giving him 4-1. Great victory for him.
Definitely a great victory for him, and you don't blame the judges giving it that score.
Luckily, Chris Lee wasn't one of the judges.
Luckily enough, Jesus Christ, sack him. Going on to Jack, he somewhat made me look a bit like an idiot. I have been saying on Twitter that I do favour him over Mervyn, but either one, you win some, you lose some. Seeing him now, after watching the fight, I do believe that he came in overconfident. I do believe that a multiple things. He came in overconfident, he was fed up, and he just couldn't give a shit. And I don't mean that as in like he couldn't give a shit about the sport, I just mean it like you step in that man's shoes for a minute, you've been scheduled to fight 3 times, your opponent's changed, you're thinking you're going from fighting a grappler to a striker to a grappler, it's like you're literally training for so many people in that lot. You at this point you just think, fuck's sake, just hurry up with a fight, I want to do it and get it out of the way, mm-hmm. on to my next one. And I think that's what possibly could have come on. And then obviously Marvin stepping up and him being ranked 14th at the time, which in UFC means nothing, that in Jack,
12th when you actually got in the octagon.
That's mad, isn't it? Ranked 14 yesterday, ranked 12 today. It's like, who's he beat the last 2 days?
Who's lost to the fall down the ranking?
So he was just fucking mental. But then obviously Jack, you've got him who's in the top 5, so maybe his ego could have shot up, like exactly like how Luke Rockhold did against Bisping, where it's like, I'm champion, I'm going to beat him easily, I'm going to walk through him. And then he got knocked out. Could be the same with Jackie. It's like, I'm in top 5. I've fought some at best. I've beat some at best. This, he was just kid. He's gonna come here. I'm gonna take him down. I'm gonna choke him out. And that very much wasn't the case, as Mervyn was willing to show. And in this case, he had more to lose than Jack did, obviously, because in this shot, he's got a shot to get into the top 5 now. If he were to lose by Jack, then yeah, he probably gets a shot, another shot in the top 10 somewhere down the line. But then again, you've got to ask yourself, hang on a minute, if I lose to this guy, I'm going to go back a step to have another fight. So if I'd actually put everything all in and win this, I might have to have one more fight. But then at the end of that, that might actually be for a title. So you've got to think of who actually had more to lose. Jack's already in the top 5, he knows. He's gonna get a title shot down the line at some point. Mervyn's one of them. He needs to climb up the ladder and get himself there. And he did it the only way he knew how. And he surprised me with how confident he was on the ground. Now I know he's got good abilities. His skill set. He's got on the ground. He's got submissions underneath his belt already. But I thought Jack's game was a lot better than his. And man, was I wrong. Mervyn was just better than him everywhere, and after the first round when Mervyn knocked him down, it was like Jack just wasn't there. He just couldn't fucking get all of his like bearings together. So throughout the fight, as we were getting cracked and cracked and cracked, it was just more autopilot taking over of what do I do now, right? Jack do this, Jack do that, and it's. I think even Marvin knew. Then obviously in the third round it was more like, right, man, this guy can take more punishment than what I thought. Take a breath, because we're going into championship rounds and I'm knackered. And it, for a guy who's young, but he's had 20 odd fights, so he's well experienced and all. So he knew in that third round that he needed to slow his pace down a bit, just take a breather. He knew that there were another 10 minutes, potential 10 minutes left of the fight. Slow your pace down and you've potentially got the win in the bag. And He did, to be honest. From round three, that fight was his all the way. And Jack didn't offer any sort of threat on the feet, on the ground, TKOing, KOing, submission. There were absolutely no threat bar from the fifth round, the last 10 seconds, which is nothing. He's absolutely nothing. And it was just a perfect win for him. This is literally just one of them stories where you're happy you've got it right, rather than going, oh, I stepped up on short notice and fuck it, I lost. It's like, you stepped up on short notice, beat the piss out of Garth for the best part of five rounds, and you're on the road to a title shot. And
I mean, this is a guy who stepped up and took the fight on short notice, but he was also training for a fight. It was taking on, I think it was Jacare next week. So he said he was just happy that it's one less week of torment in terms of that weight cutting and food intake. So for him, I don't think he saw it as a step up. I think he just saw it as he gets this done and then he can enjoy his Christmas.
It could definitely be that, but either way, this win's put him in that title picture.
Yeah.
Let's just put it that way. And not only that, he's fought Adesanya before. I'm pretty sure they went to decision. I'm pretty sure, if I can remember, people were saying it were a relatively close fight.
Yeah.
So he already sells it right there. Who's a better fighter? Was it because the judges give it Adesanya? Because we know from this card tonight that not all the judges are best judges. So who's a better fighter now? They've both had a couple more fights, more time to train, more time to evolve. I'd love to see that fight.
So let's have a quick look at next week, the last numbered pay-per-view of the year, and Davison Figueiredo gonna break the record for the quickest turnaround of a champion. I think he's breaking Matt Hughes' record when he took on BJ Penn and GSP. 21 days since the guy last fought, and he's taking on Brandon Moreno, who also fought 21 days ago when he brutally KO'd Brandon Royval. But this card is stacked. We've got, just on the main card alone, Junior Dos Santos versus Cyril Gagne, Jacare taking on Kevin Holland, Renato Moicano versus Rafael Fiziev, the co-main event, Tony Ferguson versus Charles Oliveira, and obviously that main event of Figueiredo
versus
Brandon Moreno. It's just brutal. What a brutal card. This is going to be a real way to see out the year. But then even after that, we've still got another event a couple of days before Christmas. So UFC have really been spoilers in this COVID era. I mean, I know I give them a lot of grief at the beginning of it, but They've come out fighting in terms of content, saying that in the post-fight press conference, Dana was speaking about the recent cut of Yoel Romero, and he's saying that the UFC are going to be doing some serious cuts at the end of this year, and it's looking likely that he's going to be cutting about 50 to 60 fighters. So it's going to be a massive call. I wonder if
who's going to be signing to replace him, because the fucker puts a fence on each week. He needs a fucking
fighter. This is the whole point of the Dana White Contender Series: get young, hungry fighters in on 10 short, 10 win contracts, rather than fighters who are on hundreds of thousands per contract and haven't got the best of records. So
I can understand that, but Jesus Christ, not all of your Contender Series are going to be fucking top dog.
It'll be interesting to see, for me though, if Dana and the UFC gets the same amount of grief that Vince McMahon and the WWE got when they did a lot of culling, because WWE got a lot of shit for it. We'll see that. Anyway, tune back in next week for the fallout from UFC 256. Follow me on Twitter at DJ Kirby. Follow Carlos here at Kirby_Carlos. He's still lagging way behind and getting a lot of grief.
I need some followers.
You need some followers. Keep your ears out in early 2020 for more news on Carlos's super secret five rounds project, which is coming up. We're both really, really excited for that. follow the networks at Visionaries Global Media, at Shooting the Sports Station, obviously at the Chair Shot Media Group. Thank you all for listening. That is the end.
Adios, amigos.